I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. In the Berkshires this time, in the theater shed on the western edge of the Tanglewood lawn, I'm sitting in on the rehearsal of the Kurzweil Bertolt Brecht masterpiece, not the Three Penny Opera, but the cult classic of decadence and the new German music theater between the world wars, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni. Because the Boston Symphony Orchestra's maestro, James Levine, is out sick this summer, the anything-might-happen atmosphere around the Berkshire performance feels a tiny bit like the no-net air of risk and revolution that hovered over the riotous, contentious first performances, Lottie Lanier starring, in Leipzig and Frankfurt in 1930. The prophetic power of this show, its bite into our world in America today, is one amazement. The spectacle of young professionals finding their way is another. Three of them talked with me after the first costume rehearsal. The stand-in conductor, Eric Nielsen. The mezzo, who is singing the villainous Widow Begbick, Kristen Marie Hill. And the stage director, Doug Fitch.
Opera is a funny world because... You know, you can be doing a piece like... It's one of the reasons why I think Mahagoni is such a great thing to do as an opera. Because it's also, you know, it's sort of at war with opera. It comes out of this cabaret, dark side of burlesque. And what is opera? Opera is sort of the Polo of the culture world. You know, it's elite. It's kind of... It's extremely expensive. You never make money on it. And it's really fun to do. So, and people get hurt.
People get hurt all right in the city of Mahagoni. First is a typhoon, then the hero is executed for running out of money. Kurzweil said this opera was his version of Sodom and Gomorrah. With scathing words by Bertolt Brecht, the city of Mahagoni was a fantasy of licentious pre-fascism projected onto a made-up sin city in the American desert, something like Las Vegas. The show has been called the first jazz opera and the first surrealist opera.
There's so many elements about Mahagoni, and now that I'm working on it inside of it, really deeply inside of it, I'm learning how much it really is going on in this thing. But, you know, it came out of, it is the emerging of several different artistic trajectories, I guess you could say. One of them is from cabaret and burlesque theater in Germany at that time. Right after World War I, there was this kind of a dark side that was being really celebrated down in those cabarets, and so this music comes from that. It's and it also has been influenced enormously by what Kurzweil and Brecht thought about America and what America was, what it represented to them as a kind of a free and crazy frontier land where anything could happen. And so they invented a version of America that we are actually living in now. And third was that this is Kurzweil's ambition to write an opera. So all of this lowbrow stuff that was just rich with material, he started to kind of force it to float to the surface like, you know, heavy cream. And skimming all of this stuff off the top is what we call Mahagoni. So...
I sit here listening and thinking of Charlie Chaplin, The Gold Rush, but also of Porgy and Bess. I mean, we're at a funny crossroads here. European and American, 19th century, 21st, whatever.
It's so true. And when you think about also, you know, Charlie Chaplin doing his version of Hitler and the Great Dictator, and then Porgy and Bess was absolutely totally influenced by Mahagoni. So it wouldn't have been written without this having come first. It was a huge inspiration of those folks as well. It brought jazz into the opera. It made it possible to think about other forms of music. And I think art is always just, you know, pretends to be this high-level thing that only a few people can appreciate. But at every given moment in history, it's like, okay, where's the next art coming from? And they just have to dig down deep into where the people actually are and make something mean something and pull it up.
Am I nuts, or is there a certain excitement about this whole production?
It's very exciting. First of all, Tanglewood. I mean, it's my third summer, and there's a reason why I would come back here time and time again if they asked me. It's the nature of this place and the kind of artists that are here. So that's always in the air. But this particular production, I do feel like it's augmented because as opera singers, we rarely get to perform a piece that speaks so relevantly to our times. I mean, we're usually singing about, you know, the soprano who like falls in love with the tenor. I mean, these kind of... So to be doing a piece, I mean, the one character who eats himself to death, it's so relevant to what we're facing in America right now. And so it's just a unique opportunity to really say something.
Why is this so powerful? And how are we supposed to take it?
Well, we're doing this in America. Vile has a little footnote, which I never really understand in the beginning of the score, where he talks about we're not supposed to romanticize it and make it a cowboy story type, which is, I've never really understood that fully, but I think living in the U.S., first of all, we have a character who eats himself to death. We have people, well, the sex is obviously a big element of the show. We're talking about capital punishment in this piece.
We're talking license of every kind and greed, greed as almost the code of the place.
The word that comes to my mind is insatiability. It's a constant need, and for me, this opera is about the sort of insatiable feeding of desire. Like, this is never going to go away. And the way it's set up is that the population has been created in such a way, has been given expectations such that there's no way you can ever find satisfaction or be pleased. And so what I find so similar to our own society is that we are living in a time which does create, this sort of breeds a kind of necessary insecurity. Why would you buy products that you don't need? Why would you create hundreds of thousands of, you know, billions of dollars worth of things that nobody needs? And because we don't need them, it's much more difficult and much more expensive to try to sell them. And so that quality, which is underscoring everything in our country at the moment, and yet most of us are not aware of because it passes just simply under the radar, is something that they were writing about from a perspective in Germany where they had experienced some really intense version of all of the seven deadly sins merging and forging a new kind of culture. They imagined this.
With this sense, and again, it's part of the power of this thing, that the worst is yet to come.
Well, you know, it's called The Rise and Fall of the City of Marconi. You know, it doesn't sound like it's going to end well from the very get-go. But I think that this what seems so powerful about this piece is that nobody inside the opera knows what's going on with them. Nobody gets the feeling that it's going to be bad. They're all trying to do their best. Yeah. And Jack, who is the fellow we've spoken about, who eats himself to death, he's doing this not because he even wants to eat. He's doing it because he's feeling like... Have I done well enough yet? And his friend says, don't do things by half. Go all the way. Just do it. Just do it, like the Nike commercial. And oddly enough, just do it, it's been translated to go do it, but it's the same thing as just do it, is a major motto in our own time, and it's what they'd even figured that out, Vile and Brecht. So.
Somebody calls it a diabolical entertainment.
Yeah, that's a good word.
Very good word.
That's a very good word.
Seems just right.
Yeah, especially for my character, who I've kind of come to look at as this kind of super villain. You know,
it's true, and nothing goes well. I mean, it's called The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, and thanks to you, Kristen, it goes right down the tubes.
The musician's response to decadence and war and the opportunity at Tanglewood is to make art every day. Among the rising stars, Kristen Marie Hill leaps out. Kristen, where are you coming from professionally, musically, and where are we going?
Well, I just finished. I'm in that very fun stage in between having done apprenticeships. I just did a residency with the Minnesota Opera all year. And when I'm done here, I just got a manager, so I'm going to do what most singers do. You get management, and you move to New York, and you do tons of auditions.
And what's your What's the musical past for you?
Well, I started, I came quite a bit late to opera. I grew up singing gospel, as did most of the people in my community, and had no intention of ever going into classical music. I went to college, I went and lived overseas, I lived in Paris for a while and sang jazz and pop and all sorts of things there. And then, in my mid-20s, my voice changed considerably. And that's kind of when I made a transition into studying voice, and I was directed towards opera.
How often do people say, as I felt when I saw you on stage, this looks like Jesse Norman's daughter or granddaughter?
Yeah, that comparison is made a great deal, and I didn't quite get it until I opened up. I had one of those history of opera books. I was at the bookstore, and I was kind of flipping through it, and I turned to a picture of her profile, and it almost took my breath away because I thought, oh my gosh, that's kind of my face, you know. I do see, and it's of all the people to be compared to, it's a wonderful comparison.
In Mahagoni, Christa Marie is singing the part of the monstrous madam, the widow Begbick.
Begbick often is a character who's played very much older, you know, and I think a
cast older.
So often, you know, the expectation when I come into it was that I should have this really gravelly sound, you know, of this person who's been chain smoking for years.
Person who's at the end of their career, right?
Yes,
at
the point. So. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, typically, you know, the perfect time to do a role like this is once you've sung for years and your voice has kind of seen its better days, and then you can kind of, you know, you can kind of go
throw
there.
It away.
Yeah, but you know, we're young singers, and we want our voices to be healthy, and we want them to be, you know, beautiful and resonant and all those things. So one of the things I had to work with Doug on is that, of course, he wants her to, she has to read as evil. I mean, you have to kind of
a caricaturization in some form.
Yeah, but I couldn't do it by, you know, doing like some really But we found a really good compromise. I found a way to make her evil and to speak in a very low place without
also in the body language, damage. I think.
Yes. Yes, actually it's a really good point. Like I found that, you know, as singers we have to find a way to make a character read in a way so that it doesn't hurt us vocally. So what I found that I would sit in front of the mirror, and I found that, you know, my eyes can be extremely evil.
Yeah.
And I think my eyes do about 80% of the work. Mm, on their
I
own.
I think so too.
It could.
You know, there were so many battles going on. It's and there was so much creativity going on at the same time. A long time ago, I battled with the notion of, well, what are we supposed to do about all the horrible things that are going on, you know, in the world? And do we jump into battle ourselves? And do we take up arms? And do we go and try to kill the enemy? Is that what we do? As well, I wasn't certainly born that way. I wouldn't be a very good soldier out there. And we fortunately have, you know, been given an opportunity to be able to fight these wars in a different way, with a different medium. And I think we feel like we are being passed this particular torch from those who did it, fought it in their way, you know, in the 20s and 30s in Germany. It's a similar battle, you know. So it always reminded me too, like, what was Matisse doing during the war? He was painting the most beautiful paintings, and it's a good thing he was doing that. So, you know, when I look at the George Grosz drawings and paintings and the Otto Dix things that came out of that this era, what is it that is so potent about that message? This is not beautiful to look at. They're not beautiful people that they've chosen to represent. These people, soldiers with their faces blown off in the war, standing next to prostitutes who are 75 years old. That stuff was going on, and they were depicting a reality that they was absolutely right next to them. But these pictures live, and create such an eloquent, they are so eloquent about what we can do as preceptors, or I mean, anybody can really, but that kind of ugly beauty or beautiful ugliness, I don't know what's the right way to call it. That's the tool that's being used here. It's the beauty in the war. It's the war in the beauty. It's a lot of opposing elements. At least it's that.
I like that idea of beautiful ugliness, or that in this kind of the American dream. I mean, I come from the Chicago suburbs, so you want to talk about a place that's super sanitized. I mean, there are miles and miles of subdivisions where people have these wonderful, pretty, perfect houses, but the things that have to go on in our society for that to exist, that's the ugly side that people want to talk about. And even, I think, when we were having the first read of the opera, and I was saying, you know, so much of the life we live, this life of consumerism, only exists. We're only able to go into Target and get, like, an amazing price on, I don't know, a bottle of a thing of Tide or whatever we go in there to buy, because other parts of the world or even other parts of the country are suffering tremendously. So there's the ugly underbelly that we have to pay for this life of abundance that we lead. And I feel that the music in this opera kind of reflects that very prophetically.
You do have these oases of things going on. For example, in this opera, we have Jim. We have the love story. Is it really a love story? How much are they in love? This is always a question for the staging. And that I find so... It gives the opera balance, so it's not just doomsday, but we need that contrast.
Andrew Porter in The New Yorker wrote, this was 35 years ago, but he talked about Kurt Weill's musical mastery in many, many dimensions, but he said all of that doesn't add up to the feeling of joy in men's and women's goodness that floods me, he writes, as I hear the score, mingling with the horrified contemplation of our society's wickedness.
Yes.
Perfect. Exactly.
I this opera has made me think an awful lot about the idea of community, and that we are connected, and that is the essence of our humanity. And ultimately, at the end of the opera, where you've got Bill, who has money and can save his friend and makes a choice not to because, you know, and he says, you know, I've worked so hard, I'm so sorry, but I worked hard for this money. Mm. And the fact that he chooses the money over his friend, and I think that you could either walk away from it feeling terribly depressed about the human condition, or you can walk away thinking that what is the point of us having money and having resources if we don't share it, if we're not a community, if the purpose to have things is to share them and to support one another. And so being the optimist, the constant optimist I am, I have to believe that and have to hope that an opera like this can make people think.
Erik Nielsen is playing a famous role in real life in Tanglewood, the part of the assistant conductor who takes the baton when Maestro James Levine is down for kidney surgery. You know, in Maestro Levine's absence, there is a certain kind of, hey kids, let's put on a show. Anything can happen. There's so much possibility here. And maybe that falls especially on you, Erik. What kind of a moment is this for you, especially standing in for the maestro who loves this piece and had big plans for it himself?
Well, I was originally going to do one show of Mahagoni, so I knew I was going to have to at least conduct it. But it's something else when you're put in the position where you guide the singers, you work with the stage director. And this is a big, this is a very new style for me. And part of falling in love with the piece and working through it has just changed me so much. I think it's a fantastic piece, and it's thrilling that we're doing it here at Tanglewood.
How do you and Maestro Levine collaborate on it now? Him and his summer's illness, and you sort of in the pit.
Well, I'm familiar with Maestro Levine's performances. I saw him conducted in the 90s at the Met. I saw the 1979 DVD when he brought it to the U.S. for the first time. I have seen him work with the singers. Part of opera is, and most of the work is done almost before the rehearsals actually begin. He cast all the singers. Krista Maria is here because he wanted her as Big Bic. And they're working with coaches from the Met that, who are all familiar with Levine's Tempe. But I hope to have a chance that he can see some of this work and collaborate before the premiere on the 9th.
We just heard word he's doing very, very well and wants to be involved as much as possible. And so we have been shooting the videotapes. Tomorrow or the next day, we're going to be able to show him some of that stuff and get his input. So that's very lucky and fortunate.
Eric, what's for the pure musician, for the conductor, how do we explain the staying power of Kurt Weill? I mean, specifically, people said, there were reviews, one of the Christian Science Monitor in 1933 or whatever, it said, this is absurdly dark, this is a misuse of the audience and the music, the tradition, papa, won't last. And here it is with this today challenge about it. Where is it?
Well, we were discussing the theater educating people as opposed to just having them feel something for the audience. And I think he uses, for example, we were discussing jazz earlier, he uses it, it's a combination, it's like a daring cook who like would put fish with chocolate together or something. It's something you have, a beautiful theme that everyone remembers when they leave the opera house, and then the text underneath it is extremely bitter or extremely evil or begbic or pessimistic. And it's this combination of something. It should taste sweet, but it doesn't go down that way. The music is very deceptively simple. The textures look simple, but I mean it requires tremendous flexibility and interesting colors to make it work, to make it communicate to the audience.
What is that trick in the music? In the music of Kurt Weill, and a lot of his later stuff in America is very, very familiar. The September Song and My Ship, things like that. What is the trick, the composer's trick, of music that sounds very seductive and available and is always, must be extremely hard to perform, Kristen?
Yes, you know, we talked about this a lot, particularly in the music rehearsals in the beginning, because, you know, the last opera I did at Tanglewood was Elliot Carter, which is atonal, and so you would think that would be the hardest thing.
Where do the notes come from?
Yes.
On that one, so.
Yes, and so I came into this thinking, well, it's tonal, so it'll be easier, right? And actually, it was more difficult because he kind of sets you up with this bitonality. So there's a temptation, there's a constant temptation to sing the wrong pitch. You really have to, you know, there's often two modes going on at once, and it was deceptively difficult, and I don't think any of us were prepared for that in the beginning.
I mean, I remember humming these tunes as, you know, in my youth, just really thinking, oh, God, it's such beautiful music and so simple melody, just lovely. And then I'm getting into this the score, and I'm finding these chords on the piano, and I'm going, "Oh Lord, where does that come from? It is so strange and so much more complex than you can possibly imagine." What I suddenly realized as I was putting these pieces together, thinking, "Oh, I'm going to design it now. It's going to be a lovely thing. Put the design up there." No, that didn't work that way at all. This is just it's so prevalent in every part of the way the opera is set up. The only way I could make sense of it myself is that you had mentioned before that Kurt Weill and Brecht, they were having it out when they were writing this thing. This was the last thing that they did together. And in fact, I really feel that there was a war, maybe two or three wars, written right into this opera. There was the war between the two of them, trying to, you know, Brecht really pushing for this thing to be a powerful, angry metaphor to make get people upset, and Kurt Weill just really trying to make beautiful music. Mm-hmm. And that combination is what makes the chocolate, fish, bittersweet, sour combination. And of course, there was also the war that was they had just been through, and there was another one coming up, and that's there too.
Last word?
I didn't say why I love Tanglewood so much, but now I'm going to go to capitalism. For me, Tanglewood is an investment. Everybody I'm rubbing elbows with here are my friends for life, and it's such a privilege to work with people who love doing what they're doing and do it so extremely well. And I know that I'm going to know all these people when I'm in 20 years, 30 years. We're everywhere. Yeah.
May I say, it's a huge privilege to be sitting out there watching this rehearsal and to feel that you're in an extremely generous, selfless place of enormous gifts, and people having wild fun too.
It is incredible fun. More fun, really, than I've had anywhere else I've worked. And a lot of it has to do with there's something very magical that happens in the selection process. I've said this each year, because somehow from that, whatever 10-minute audition they do for the fellows that come here, the vocal fellows in particular, they manage to bring these people here who are amazing artists and who have so much to give and who aren't just great singers. They're interesting people and artists with a tremendous amount of integrity. So when we're on stage together, there is so much generosity and collaboration, and we just kind of feed off each other. It's really special.
I think it's important to mention too, just because, you know, Tanglewood, as a place that is right between the moments when everybody has been working all their youth and all of their passion is brought here, and it's a big stew pot for that, and you get to merge with all the people who've been doing this as a profession for years and years and years as well. And there is this magical moment. It's sort of like a kind of adolescence, but a lovely one, when everybody is just has all of those things coming together, and talent, and it's before the drudgery of this stuff as a profession. Not to say that this is a drudgery profession by any means, but when you have to suddenly start to exchange the art and fit it into a world that of realism, I mean, you're a real world, it makes it much more complicated. Here, without that necessity, it's just it really is a magic place.
Thank you. Don't let the agent spoil you, Kristen. Thank you, Doug Fitch, Eric Nielsen, and Kristen Marie Hill. Those three Tanglewood performances of The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni are Saturday to Monday, August 9th, 10th, and 11th, 2008. Thanks to Sarah Archambault for editing our conversation. Drop us a line about opera, about music, and art at www.radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden.